Well, good afternoon to you. Welcome to St. Andrews. My name is Alex, in case I haven't met you before. You do have the Bible passage and the sermon outline in your Connect bulletin for you to be able to follow along. Small print. Small print is that often neglected information that, well, many of us fail to read. The essential product information, manufacturer's instructions, the warnings that often appear on a product when you buy them or before you buy them. Some small print seems pretty obvious, like it really doesn't need to be told. It's very obvious. But sometimes it's still there for the minority to warn them about particular dangers. Here are a few examples. I'm told they're quite true. An antenna with the warning, do not attempt to install if drunk, pregnant, or both. In case you were thinking about it. Fireworks, flammable, do not put in your mouth. That great American delicacy, canned cheese, that says, for best results, remove your cap. Remove the cap. A sun visor on a car. Warning, do not drive with this sunshade in place. Remove from windshield before you start the ignition. Very helpful. And, well, this is unfortunate. The Superman costume, wearing this garment does not enable you to fly. Such a shame. All these warnings seem obvious, but they're important for the minority of people. And as obvious as warnings and small print might be, some of us aren't in the habit of reading them. For instance, when you're updating a program on your computer or you're buying insurance, how many of you actually tick that box? You know, when you all tick that box, how many of you actually read the terms and conditions? How many of you do it? Not that many. There are all sorts of reasons why we don't read the small print. Maybe because it's too painstakingly long. It's just boring. It takes a lot of time. You don't have the time. Other times it might be because it's just too confusing, you give up all these words and long phrases. Other times you might just be, well, you're confident that you know what you're getting into. You know enough about the product that you think you can get by without worrying about all the small print, all the dangers that might come. You're in, you're sold, you want to get into it. One of the things I find refreshing about reading the Gospels is that with Jesus, there is no small print. With Jesus, there is no small print. He's absolutely clear about what it means to follow him. And over and over and over again in the Gospels, he's telling his followers, or those who might be his followers, what it looks like to follow him. And this passage that we just read before from Luke 14 is no exception. Jesus is really blunt. In fact, you would have seen it three times. Verse 27. Verse 26, first of all, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father, mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Or verse 27, and whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. And then verse 33, in the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Jesus is being very blunt. If you want to follow him, if you want to be his disciple, you're all in. You give everything you got. Now, in case this is a little bit intimidating for you, just a moment, think about who Jesus is talking to. Look at who he's talking to. Verse 25, great crowds, large crowds, were traveling with Jesus. Here was a whole group of people, a myriad of people. Yes, there were his disciples, the insiders, the 12, those people whom Jesus was training for full-time ministry. But then you have all sorts of other people, the curious onlookers, the people who've heard about Jesus. Here is the miracle worker. Here is the guy who heals and teaches and says extraordinary things. The curious people who are interested and want to find out more. Or then there might be the people who've been listening to Jesus for a little while. They're sort of semi-attached, interested. They're for him, but they're wanting to still find out a little bit more. Note that Jesus is speaking to a broad group of people, a very inclusive group of people. And this is the thing. it's important for us to realize that there are no two levels of Christianity. Because often we think that there are different types of Christians. On one level, there are those devoted people. You know, the insiders, the disciples, the guys who are really devoted to Christianity, the ones who are, you know, the ministers, the monks, the missionaries, those who are really hardcore, switched on. But then for the rest of us, there are Christians who believe, who assent, who agree, but we don't want to make a big deal about it. We don't want to carry on. We go to church, we say our prayers, we're in trouble. But otherwise, Jesus is simply there. He's there, but he's not really there in the midst of things, in the middle of everything going on. I want you to notice, Jesus says, if anyone comes to me. For Jesus, there is no two levels. There's no two standards. Full discipleship is the absolute requirement of anyone who would follow him. It's not optional. It's not like Jesus says to the crowd, listen guys, listen in all of you, I'm going to give you life and life to the full. But then he turns to his disciples, the insiders, the hardcore ones, and says, well, for you guys are a little bit different. It's going to be harder for you guys. You guys have to take up your cross and follow me. No, there's one standard. Jesus says there's one standard and one standard only. I do not hide the cost. I don't hide the difficulties. If you're in with everything you got. There is no small print with Jesus. And as we think about discipleship, following Jesus as he describes it this afternoon, from this passage you can see that there are three things that Jesus talks about what it means to follow him. It's about making the right priority, doing the maths, and then maintaining the difference. So first point, have the right priority. This is verses 26 to 27. We're going to spend most of our time here. Jesus uses that word, you would have noticed it, hate. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yet even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Why does he choose that really provocative word, hate? Does Jesus really want his followers to be hostile towards their family? Well, it doesn't really quite make sense because after all, here is Jesus who tells his followers, love your enemies. Here is Jesus who in those last moments of his earthly life hung on the cross praying for the forgiveness of his killers. Here is Jesus whom the New Testament says God created the world through him. God created all things, including family and marriage, through Jesus. Is this really the Jesus who wants us to hate our family? I don't think this is what he's saying. He's not using the word hate in any particular normal sense that you are supposed to detest or loathe or be hostile towards your family. He's using it in a different sense. Because often in Hebrew literature, yes, hate can be construed as being active hate, but there are instances as well in which hate is being used comparatively. Many of you know the story of Jacob, one of the patriarchs, way early on in the Bible. Jacob married two sisters, Rachel and Leah. We'll be honest, Jacob wasn't a particularly good guy. And in Genesis 29, we're told that Jacob loved Rachel, but he hated Leah. Now, you won't see that in the modern translations, but in the Hebrew, that's what it actually said. He hated Leah. Now, did Jacob actually hate Leah? No, he didn't. Because in verse 30 of Genesis 29, it says that he loved Rachel more. What it means is that he hated Leah, not actively, but in comparison to his love for Rachel. Jacob's love for Rachel was so strong, so possessive, so full on that his feelings for Leah looked like hate in comparison. Even though Jacob didn't neglect, abuse or harm physically anyway, Leah in any sense, it's just compared to his attitude towards his obsession with Rachel, his feelings towards Leah look like hate. Now, the word hate is used there comparatively, but it's used elsewhere in the Old Testament and in the New Testament when God compares his feelings for Jacob compared to his brother Esau. Did God hate Esau? No, but he says, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Now, I just want to park here for a few moments so that we can work out the implications of what Jesus is saying. He's not saying, I want you to hate your father and mother. I want you to hate your spouse, hate your children, hate your brothers and sisters. You're just going to be that type of person. No. He says, I want you to love me more. Jesus is saying to that vast crowd that is following him, I don't want to be a passing interest. I don't want to be some sort of casual or momentary devotion. Someone that you have in your life amongst all the other things that are going on. I want you to make me your top priority. You know how every now and again in life you have those conversations that you remember, that just stick in your mind amongst all the other conversations that you have ever have in life? There is something that's said, a word, a phrase, something that impacts you, that sears you into your consciousness. When I was 18, a few months after I became a Christian, I was having a conversation with a guy who was kind of mentoring me. And this guy had just recently been married. And he was telling me that his love for his wife should come second. It should be the second love in his life. And I thought this was a little bit strange. You know, aren't you, this is not particularly romantic, mate. You know what you've gotten yourself in for? You know, I promised to love. And did you listen to your vows? I remember thinking, this guy's not going to be a particularly functional husband if his wife is going to treat his wife in that way. But he said it was actually about priority. It's not that he didn't love his wife. He loved his wife very, very much. It's just he wanted to love Jesus more. And in loving Jesus the most amongst everything else in his life, that would actually make him a better husband. He would be able to love his wife better. He'd be able to be the husband that he should be to her. It was about priority. Now, the priority that Jesus is demanding of his disciples is comprehensive. Amongst all the other loves that people have in life, all the other loves, he's wanting to be the first love. Think about the range. Think about all the different things that people love in life. Because Jesus here is giving us a glimpse of the range. You see, on the one side, he's speaking to a very traditional culture. He says, He says to them, you've got to love me more than your father, your mother, you're more than your spouse, more than your children. He's speaking to a very traditional culture, a culture that was patriarchal, family-orientated, a family-orientated society. In that particular society, your life revolved around your family and your extended family. You did what your family wanted. You didn't abandon your family. You didn't disgrace them. You didn't move away from your family. Your career was what your family wanted. You married whom your family wanted. In this traditional culture, family was the top priority. Now, some of you who are from a more traditional background would know what I'm talking about, how family can be the absolute priority. But Jesus doesn't leave it there. You see, on the one hand, he talks to traditional culture, but on the other hand, he talks to a more Western, modern, individualistic culture. I wonder if you notice that. He says not only to hate your father and your mother, your spouse, your children, but he says you've got to even hate your own life. You see, Western culture is very secular and individualistic. We say to people in Western culture, no one has the right to tell me what to do with my life. I call the shots in my life. I determine my priorities and goals in life. My life for me is about identifying those things I want in life and just going for it. Self-fulfillment, self-expression. So do you see the range? He's talking to the traditional family, community-orientated culture, but he's also very inclusive, looking far advanced to that more modern Western individualistic culture. Wherever you stand, Jesus is talking to everybody. He's saying, put me first. Whoever you are, wherever you've come from. And it's not surprising that he would be so comprehensive, because he knows that we all will love something and love someone. We were built to love. We're built to love something that we put as the absolute priority in life. And the reality is, we will give to what it is, whatever it is, whomever it is, we love the most. We'll work extremely hard, we'll sacrifice all our spare thoughts, we'll be devoted to that thing or that person that we love the most. We'll give all sorts of things for it. That's the reality of who we are. Whatever it is that takes priority for you, whether it is your father and mother, your spouse, your children, it might be your career, your studies, your sense of approval or standing in life, your own sense of comfort, we'll sacrifice a whole lot for whatever it is we love most in life. St. Augustine, in his book called The Confession, says, our problem isn't that we love. Our problem is that our loves are out of order. Our problems are disordered loves. Our problem isn't that we love things too much, it's that we love God too little. Because he was saying we were built to love God first and foremost. If there is a God who exists, who created us, who formed us and sustains us day by day, shouldn't it make sense that we give to God our first things, our first love? Augustine was saying our problem isn't that we love too much, it's that we love God too little. We love Jesus too little. Our loves are disordered. Now, this creates all sorts of problems for us. Say you're from a traditional background. Family is really, really important to you. Some of you know the pain of disappointing your parents. It might not be something you consciously recognize, but it's there in the background. You've done something, or in some sort of way, you feel as though you've disappointed your parents, and the pain follows you around. What about others? Career is your thing. You worked extremely hard through high school and university. You sacrificed a whole lot in order to get on a particular trajectory with your career, to achieve a lot, whatever goals, subconscious or conscious they might be. But somehow, things haven't worked out. Someone's done something to you, or you failed in some particular way. Some events have transpired and it's not working out and you're struggling with it. Whatever it is that hasn't worked out in your life, be it family, career, whatever else, how do you get that sense of peace? Well, Augustine says you can try two things. First of all, you can hate. My parents are idiots. They just have too high expectations. They're impossible expectations. They're hard on me. They're too hard on me. They just won't relent. Okay, sure, I failed in my career. Okay, I haven't achieved my goals. All right, there are other people in my class, in my course, that have gotten ahead of me. Things haven't worked out. But look at those people who get what they want in their career. They end up being so smug and conceited. I don't want to be like that anyway. So you can hate. Or you can do something else. Augustine says you can either choose to hate or you can overcome. You can try to overcome what your parents think of you. You can try to overcome how you fail in your career. You can overcome with whatever is crushing you by choosing to love God more. Now, that doesn't mean that your problems in life suddenly disappear and life is all beer and Skittles, so to speak. But it does mean that if you're focusing on God, if you're remembering the deep and abiding love that he has for you, the extent to which he's shown his love for you, a love that cannot be taken away, then if you absorb that, not just as an intellectual exercise, but in your heart, it drops down those floors, then you can have that ballast that will help you to negotiate those storms in life. You can have that deep poise and confidence and assurance that won't be taken away. Jesus is saying, it's not enough just to have me as part of your life. Amongst all the other things, I'm just like icing on the cake. No, I've got to be your top priority, your first love. I've got to be the foundation. Now, all of this gives us the context for what Jesus then says in verse 27. Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, if this statement doesn't confront you, if it sort of just washes over you, then I don't think you've really understood it. How confronting it is to have a symbol of execution as the essential image of living the Christian life. I mean, say you start a new job and your new employer comes to you and says, right now, welcome to the company, we're going to begin. Strap yourself into the electric chair. Get ready to hear the crack of the rifles. Put the blindfold on, smoke your last cigarette, follow me. No, it's absolutely confronting. And to Jesus' original audience, they knew what he was saying. Because they knew that it was the Roman custom to force a criminal to carry his cross to his place of execution. When Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me, they'd probably seen that done before. They knew the ramifications. When he says, take up your cross and follow me, they're thinking, this is just bizarre. This is outlandish. This is trouble. You see, Jesus is giving us a warning. He's giving us a warning because very often in the Christian life, when we start off as Christians, we can often come into the temptation of thinking, things are going to be better now. Things are going to be different. I'm signing up with the King of the universe. He's going to be my friend. I'm going to pray about things that worry me and they're going to be sorted out because Jesus answered prayer. I'm going to be good to him. Jesus is going to be good to me. It's going to be fantastic. But Jesus is saying, no. If you make me your top priority, that means my priorities become your priorities. My values become your values. It's a glorious and great life, but it's not an easy life. This is full disclosure. He's telling us what it looks like to prioritize him. It's important for us because very often we put conditions on Jesus. We put conditions on him if we're going to follow him. Many years ago, just after, in fact, a few months after I became a Christian, I was playing a rugby match. I played rugby a lot back then growing up. And this was a particularly important rugby match. It was the grand final. And my team were winning. We had the ascendancy most of the game until things turned and our opposition had now gained momentum and the match was quite close. And I remember in a particular point in the match, I don't know what prompted me to do it, but I said, God, if you get me through this, if you help us win, I'm going to stick it out with you. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to make this thing happen. I'm going to do it. Deal? Now, I don't think I'm in the minority, okay, because I know all sorts of people put these conditions on God. God, if you help me with this particular thing, I'm going to follow you. You be good to me, I'm going to be good to you. Now, it didn't turn out well for me on that particular instance because I missed a tackle, a try went through and they won the match. We lost. But isn't it often the case? We put conditions on God. And when we put conditions on God, we're not prioritizing Jesus. We're prioritizing our own agenda. So this is the first lesson that Jesus wants to learn about discipleship. It's about having the right priority. The second and third lessons go much quicker, you're probably happy to hear. The second is that you have to do the math. So that's verses 28 to 33. And in these verses, Jesus tells us two parables. Both involve costly enterprises. One is costly of money, the other one is costly of lives. And the first one is basically about surveying. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. You don't see this so much in Hong Kong, and fortunately it didn't happen with the Life Centre. But often when I've been on holidays in other parts of Asia, Thailand, Vietnam and all that sort of stuff, you do see it. developers who start constructing a resort or holiday villas, apartments, in the anticipation of this surge in tourist activity. But you come along and you find this construction that has stopped because the developers ran out of money. And it's been stopped for months, maybe years. Grass is growing in the concrete. It's been that long. And people like me come along and they're curious and they think, what's happened? Did they employ dud surveyors? Which bank agreed to giving them the initial loan? Haven't they done their maths? Didn't they count the cost? Because now they're unable to finish their project. They just look absolutely stupid. They didn't count the costs. The second parable makes the same points. The king who does a head count of his own troops, his own army, to ensure he has enough to fight the rival king with his army. If he can defeat that king, that he gets on top, but if he doesn't have the numbers, he can't win and it costs lives. So he does the maths. Now the two parables essentially make the same points. You've got to do the maths. You've got to stop and think. That's what both of them say. The man building the tower must first sit down and estimate the cost. The king going out to encounter another king in war must first sit down and consider the cost. That's what both of them must do. Now think about what discipleship means. This is what Jesus is saying to that vast crowd following him. Do not be naive about what it means to follow me. There's going to be some difficulty as you take on my priorities and my values and my choices in life. Do not be naive. Count the cost. Do the maths. In 1812, Adoniram Judson, aged 23, sailed for Burma with his wife. He married her just 12 days earlier. Now, Judson was the first American missionary overseas. He spent the rest of his life in Burma. And he wrote to Anne Hasseltine's father, asking for her hand in marriage. And this is what he said. He says, I have now to ask whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring, to see her no more in this world, whether you can consent to her departure and her subjugation to the hardships and sufferings of missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the dangers of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps even a violent death. Could you imagine writing this to a prospective father-in-law? Think about it for a moment. Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you? Can you consent to all this in the hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory with the crown of righteousness? I mean, what's staggering is that this guy writes this to a prospective father-in-law. Not just that, but he's 23 and he's fully aware of the costs of following Christ and what his particular call is. It's staggering. What was the father-in-law's response? I'll let my daughter decide. What did she say? Yes. Now, we might look at this and feel kind of sentimental. Isn't it remarkable, inspirational? We might feel warmed and cozy about it for a few moments. But we dismiss it pretty easily because we say, that's not my calling. I'm going to be a Christian, sure, but that's just too devoted. That's for the ministers, monks, and missionaries, and that's not me. But we forget that Jesus is speaking to a large crowd. Everyone with different stories. Everyone with different baggage, different priorities in life. And he's saying, if you're going to follow me, you've got to make me your top priority. And so that means for all of us, we do it in those moment-by-moment decisions. Not the big and glamorous ones in life only, but in those small, ordinary decisions. It's not just the, what career am I going to follow? When am I going to change jobs? Whom am I going to marry? But it's, how do I spend my Friday and Saturday evenings? How do I talk to my colleagues at work? Who do I go out with? How do I spend my time and money? Do I do I choose to get involved in particular things at church, even when it's a bit of a drain on time? How do I juggle all those various balls in my life? You see, it's important to make these choices, to do the maths, not just for the big things, but for all those things in life. So it just works into being a habit. Because all these various actions do form habits. And if we're not giving expression to our faith, if we're not active in making those decisions, then after a while we can walk down the road and find that we've wandered a far way from Jesus. We're a long way from devotion with him. So we've got to do the maths in those big and those ordinary decisions in life. Lastly, and very quickly, we maintain the difference. Verses 34 and 35. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It's thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear. What's salt used for? Well, often in our day, it's used for taste. Many of us are trying to get salt out of our diet. Does our health no good? But in Jesus' day, salt was essentially a preservative. Salt was used to stop meat from falling apart and going bad. Jesus is saying to his disciples, you guys have to be salt. You guys have to be involved in the world around you to stop it from falling apart and going bad. In those communities that you find yourself in, use what God has given you. Use your time, your skills, your opportunities. Use your vocation. Use your relationships to stop the world from going bad. Do it for good. That's what it means to follow me. And he's saying, you've got to maintain this. Because if salt loses its saltiness, if it loses that distinctive aspect of it, then it's no good for anything anymore. You're not my disciple anymore. My priority is that you care for those around you, that you make me the first thing in your life. And the way you do that is by behaving like I do, by seeking the good of others. Maintain the difference. Now, sometimes reading small print is not enjoyable at all. It's not exactly as if you read small print for fun. You know, you take a massive instruction manual with you, or all these insurance documents with you on a holiday at the beach to read. And you're just there flipping through them for kicks while you're on the poolside, sipping a martini. Now, that seems a little bit odd. And as we read, think about the small prints of discipleship, we might be thinking anything from this as being awkward and tedious to outright painful. You read the small print and you think, I'm not sure if I want to sign up for this. But Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. And often we think that that's just far too much. Jesus could have used other metaphors for self-denial. But he used this one because it became the means by which he denied himself for us. You see, Jesus literally took up his cross for us. There was no metaphor involved. He lived the life that we should have lived and died the death that we should have died. Jesus stood in our place. He stood in your place and identified with you. You see, when Jesus went to the cross, he paid for all your sin, your rebellion, our propensity to love other things more than we love God, to be devoted to those things more than we're devoted to God. And when Jesus was at the cross, the moment you put your life in his hands, God sees you there. It's like you're being scorned and spat upon. You're being ridiculed. You're having crown of thorns placed on your head. You're having nails driven through your hands. Jesus paid the price on your behalf. He stood in your place. He's identified with you, and therefore we now identify with him. We take up our cross. Now, there is a cost in following Jesus. But think about what it cost him. And so we fix our eyes on the cross, being aware that, yes, being a Christian does require some self denial, but it's nothing in comparison with what he went through on our behalf. It is a hard life to live, but it is the best life for us because we are in the service of our Maker and Redeemer, the one who sustains the universe, the one who sustains us moment by moment, and who promises us much better to come. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for this reminder of what it means to be devoted to you. We confess, Lord, that amongst all the things that you give us in life, amongst all the things that we're able to love, we don't often love you first. We love the things that you give us rather than you. Lord, forgive us. As we come now to the Lord's table, remind us of the cross, the price that Jesus paid, his body broken, his blood shed on our behalf. And guide us, Lord, give us your Spirit, equip us, give us endurance so that we can consistently prioritize, put you first, count the cost, make you the very center, not an add-on to life. Lord, help us to do this for your glory and for the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.